Welcome to the Local Shop Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Noyce, and this is the podcast for everything to do with the convenience sector and the issues facing local shops. On this episode, I'm joined by ACS Chief Executive James Lohman.
Hello.
And Head of Policy and Public Affairs, Ed Woodall.
Hello.
In the final days before the Conservative Party members choose the next Prime Minister. But that's not our topic of conversation today, because what is effectively the final week of the current government has led to a whole heap of announcements, consultations and speeches on issues that affect convenience stores. And the first issue we need to talk about is a speech made by Michael Gove on Tuesday, where he set out his support for an all-in model for a deposit return scheme in England and Wales. Ed, I'll come to you first. What does an all-in model look like, and why is it potentially a problem for retailers?
So an all-in model as we know it now, as the government set out in their consultation, is about no size restrictions on the products, the bottles, drinks, containers that can come back, and limited restriction on the types of material that will come back as well. So HDPE plastic, PET, glass and cans. So it includes all of those materials.
So in practice, what kind of liquids are we looking at in those materials? What houses those sort of things?
So obviously that would include products like milk. It would include obviously your sort of soft drinks and water, and all drinks containers would be included in those things.
And things, cans of beans and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's definitely some hygiene and food and health and safety issues related to it. But what I should stress is that actually there's a little bit of ambiguity about exactly what all-in means, because Michael Gove has made this speech to make a statement about his support for it, perhaps in his last week in this government. But it's not clear actually about the detail. And actually what really needs to get down to, and what retailers really need to do, is understanding the detail of what it means, of whether it means that all retailers have to take back these products. Yeah. Or what size is included within it. So really the devil is in the detail, and we haven't got that detail yet. Now, I understand from talking to DEFRA and others that actually we can expect a bit more detail on the announcement now. But what Gove has done is actually positioned himself, perhaps exiting, as really supportive of an all-in scheme.
So this isn't government policy now. It's the speech has been made, but nothing official yet.
Yeah, it would be unusual if the Secretary of State announced this and then we hear something completely different when we hear the formal. But these are unusual times, you know, they're unusual political dynamics. So I think we shouldn't count anything in or out particularly. It is a meaningful indication of where government thinking is on this. So we have to take it seriously. And it's really important, because the design of a deposit return scheme is what this is all about. And from our point of view as retailers, almost all of this is about what obligations are we going to be under to collect products coming back to stores, or collect packaging coming back to stores. Do we have to do that through deposit return machines in store, or do we do that manually as well? We have a particular problem with manual collections just because of the time, the queuing, and the hygiene implications and the storage implications for that. So this really all to play for, and it's still all to play for despite what we've heard this week. But I think when we heard that, we were quite disappointed in the office, because we feel that the most important, the way to target a deposit return scheme is towards on-the-go consumption. So at the moment, most people, if you consume a product at home, you dispose of that packaging through your curbside collection. There are flaws and problems with curbside collection, but, and he referred to those actually as well, about reform of that, which is very welcome.
Yeah, and that's an important point, isn't it? Because if curbside wasn't working, I suppose Gove wouldn't be recommitting to making curbside more consistent and more available to people.
Absolutely. I mean, I was really interested to see some of the reactions to this. He's explicitly not saying we're going to replace curbside collection with a deposit return scheme. He's saying we're going to do both. And my concern is that those two things, that the deposit return scheme, as we're interpreting it right now, and curbside collection, there'll be a lot of crossover between those two things.
And essentially, as a consumer, you will have to pay essentially to put, you will not get your deposit back under an all-in scheme if you put it in your curbside recycling. So there's a cost to them recycling. And I still think that there's a real thing for politicians to consider about the impact on consumers, who mostly are recycling at home and doing it responsibly and doing it well. So how this actually impacts them and the fact that they're paying for it. And our own research shows that actually people don't like the idea of walking past the recycling bin where they can recycle and having to take things back to another location.
Of course, yeah, especially things that are potentially now going to be very heavy, glass, cans, all those sort of things, that can't be crushed at home, can't be taken apart at home.
There's no argument that there's a gap in on-the-go recycling. So yes, Someone buys a soft drink, whatever it is, from a convenience store or from a food-to-go outlet, whatever it is, and they consume it, and when they finish it, most people put that in a bin, and that doesn't, in most cases, that doesn't get recycled. So there is a strong case for how do you capture that quite significant amount of packaging. And to our mind, that's where a deposit return scheme should start off, should be thinking about how do you capture that packaging that's currently left out of the current means of recovering.
Yeah, I remember talking about this on Sky News maybe 2 years ago almost. And at the time, we were in the initial phase, and the main message there was this raises more questions than it does answers. And even just the phrase all in, as you've seen, that raises enough questions in itself. And this is a really big change to infrastructure, which is going to require significant funding. So it's really important that the government gets this right and answers all of the questions, because you know, if not, we're going to have potentially lots of machines, lots of infrastructure that is, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds of potentially wasted money.
And in a way, that's why we don't want to rush this. We want to see, Scotland have already committed to do it, and we want to see how they structure their scheme and how it works. We've also done some great work with Hubbub, the charity that run a project in Leeds called Leeds by Example that looked at on-street recycling. And some of the findings from that are really interesting and need to feed into this. So we'll continue to talk to government on what we found so far, and all the options should stay in play around, particularly around infrastructure on the street.
Yeah, just remember, just everyone listening, just this is quite a complex issue, as you've probably demonstrated in the discussion. We've done quite a simple breakdown of what are the features of the deposit return scheme that we need to see. And that's just one page of the infographic. So if people haven't seen that, that's a good way of getting a sort of being caught up on this.
I would just keep an eye on our social media channels. It's all over that. So the next issue we've been dealing with this week, been a busy week, is one where unfortunately the government, we don't think he's getting it right, and that's on crime. So on Thursday, the Office for National Statistics and the Home Office published some pretty shocking figures which demonstrate why more action is needed to deal with offenders. And I'm going to go through a couple of the figures from the Home Office release because they really do stand out to me. So overall, less than 8% of reported crime results in a suspect being charged. And on theft, just 1 in 4 reported incidents even ends up with a suspect being identified, let alone dealt with. And when you look at the time that it takes for forces to come to a conclusion on theft, which most of the time is, sorry, there's nothing we can do, that's gone down from 7 days in 2016 to just 2 days now. Do you think these figures will be a surprise to retailers?
No. Retailers, no. I mean, what do we hear back consistently? A lot of retailers don't even report theft. So it's a quarter of incidents where a suspect is identified. Well, there's a whole load of other offences not even reported, so it's way less than that.
Yeah, and that's a really important point, isn't it? Because when we hear official statistics coming out and saying, oh, there's been a drop in theft, what that actually probably means is retailers are so fed up with reporting, Absolutely. They just don't bother.
Oh, yeah. So any official figures on reported shop theft, I always take with a huge amount of salt, because for that exact reason. And whether we call it screening, whether we call it assessing out, whatever, but priorities adopted by police forces, police and crime commissioners, and to some extent driven by or discussed at government level, that's what's leading to this. You know, there are police forces just not having a policy of not investigating shop theft over under a certain threshold.
Sure.
And so, you know, so therefore no surprise doesn't get reported. And you can hardly blame retailers. These things, unfortunately, will further demotivate retailers, because they'll be saying, well, if I do report crime, what's the chance of anything actually happening? And all the time and the cost and the effort of providing that information to the police have gone that wild goose chase. Sadly, I think this will lead to more inaction, and sadly, I understand why.
And I suppose the police are on the front line. They are the first point of contact. They get a lot of criticism for not responding. But we understand they are under a lot of pressure. So who's actually responsible for setting those priorities and making sure they've got enough resource to do the job properly?
So it's quite a complicated picture around police funding. It's not straightforward, but fundamentally, who sets the priorities for police in your force area? It is the Police and Crime Commissioner. They'll have a police and crime plan. They'll set out what issues they really want to address and tackle. And actually, we've found from our analysis that very few, I think it's about 4 out of 40, actually reference in any way business crime, retail crime in those strategies. And that's been a big part of what we've been trying to do with our work with the Home Office, to try and get that up the agenda for the Police and Crime Commissioners. So that's one sense in which there's sort of fund priorities from Police and Crime Commissioners. The other sense is around funding for policing overall, central funding, and that's been a big part of this election leadership campaign. Boris Johnson obviously making big commitments around policing numbers, and I think for the next spending review, when it comes to public sector departments and looking to get more funding, I think policing will be top of the front of the queue to try and get that funding back in.
I mean, and we talk about all sorts of different ways in which we can deal with crime and stop reoffending, and police are part of that. They're not always the core part of that, but police numbers at heart are absolutely essential to making this work, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the question is, what is going to happen next? I can allow myself to be a little bit optimistic about this for two reasons, really. Firstly, both the candidates for leadership have talked about increasing police numbers. In fact, a number of the candidates who knocked out early did as well. So this has become something which they obviously feel is something they want to announce and they feel is going to be popular. I think they're right. I think there's also, I suppose, why is it going to be popular? It's because people's perception of their quality of life to a large extent relates to their perception of crime and the impact of crime in their local area, and particularly in the communities where they live in, which is exactly the communities which convenience stores are serving. So I do think we're starting to see the development of some political will to intervene in a meaningful way in this. But, you know, it's still, there's a lot to do. So this isn't going to be a quick decision.
We'll be staying close to it. I mean, we active campaign with the Home Office. There's a lot going on this behind the scenes.
Victims Code consultation.
Yes, again, another thing out this week. So the final thing I want to touch on that's been making headlines in our sector this week are employment costs and workers' rights. We've had a couple of consultations. So the government has just this morning put out proposals to give compensation and protection to flexible workers, as well as separate plans announced earlier this week to reform the way that statutory sick pay works. James, you were at the Low Pay Commission this week giving evidence. What's the current story of employment in our sector?
Well, I was really positive about the session we had with the Low Pay Commission, because this is really one of the key things we were saying. If you look at all our research, our colleague survey, our National Living Wage survey, our local shop report, what it shows is that we're a really good employer as a sector. So we offer local employment. Most people walk to work in a convenience store. We offer flexible employment, but flexible sometimes uses as a bit of a euphemism for sort of one-way flexibility. In our sector, that's not true. It's flexible for both parties and also quite secure work, you know, if that. So I think we're a really good model. And what worries me about increases in wage costs and so on is that we head to a point where conventional employment becomes so expensive that businesses try and find ways around it through what, you know, slightly lazily calling it the gig economy work and so on, which doesn't have any of these sort of protections, isn't two-sided flexibility that generally works for employee and employer. So I worry that the more those costs go up, the really good employment models actually get undermined by some of those perhaps less good employment models.
Yeah, and some of those gig economy models and some of the models that have been demonised, things like zero-hours contracts, not necessarily a huge thing in our sector.
No, they're actually quite low in our sector. So all of our evidence from independent retailers suggests only about 4% use them. And actually, they're usually at the request of the employee on the basis that they might be doing some kind of holiday work, a student returning from university, or those kind of things. But actually, as James said, the employment that we offer in the sector is naturally flexible, because people often come back into working in the convenience sector when they have other commitments that they need to balance around their job. Yeah. So in a way, it doesn't need to be, zero-hour contracts don't need to be a part of it, because that's not how we work as a sector.
And in our report, we find that most people are generally positive about working in the sector. They think it has a you know, good impact on their lives, about reducing loneliness, about all sorts of things that are, you know, are those things that are just beyond the wage rates.
Exactly. Yeah. Working close to where you live is a really great benefit. Most people walk to work. All of those factors play into it being working around your daily life. And I think that's a really positive thing we need to talk about more.
And part of this evidence session and part of what the Low Pay Commission are considering now is what future wage rates are going to look like. In 2020, we're set to hit the 60% of median earnings target. Beyond that, we're sort of in a bit of a free rein as to what it could be. In your opinion, what's a sensible target for future wage growth?
I think it's difficult to set targets for wage growth. And I think anyone that's setting out a strategy for anything at the minute will not have a very long horizon for that strategy, because it's quite difficult to understand all the different factors that are going to play in. I think the best approach for the government and the Low Pay Commission to take is look at the evidence, look at it on an annual basis, objectively working with us, with trade unions, with academics, to understand what's going on in the market, and then move forward to increase the wage rate as high as possible without damaging employment opportunities in our sector and other sectors.
Yes, because that is the danger, isn't it? When it becomes a political bargaining tool, when it becomes a campaigning tool, that's when we just start hearing crazy numbers that could really do some damage.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a political pressure. You know, it's an easy thing if you're campaigning to sort of buy votes with other people's money in a way. You know, who doesn't? You know, who wouldn't like the idea of that? But yeah, there's some sort of more international research. The OECD, for example, there is this target emerging in the debate around having the minimum level set at 2/3 of median earnings. So as you say, currently it's 59%. Next year it'll be 60%. So that would be a very significant increase, depending on how quickly they wanted to get there. And quite unprecedented, really. There's no country in the world that has a minimum wage rate of that level. So, you know, this is really significant. This is potentially very significant increase in costs. And what we have to do is just keep talking about the impact, about the jobs in our sector, about how retailers are responding to increases, so that we know they cut back hours in store. We know that they delay investments or don't make investments in the stores. And that's a bit of a catch-22, because you don't make those investments, it's very hard to lift your business up to being higher margin on a higher margin basis. Yeah. That means that you're going to be able to make the money, which is going to mean you're going to be able to pay the people working in the store. So I think there's always a negative response to increased costs. Like you just try and trim those costs back as much as you can. There's maybe a more positive approach, which is, you know, easy to talk about, very hard to do, which is to say, no, we're going to invest our way out of this, transform our businesses. But that's not easy to do in the market. That's not easy to do in a very tough competitive market.
We talk about investment as improving a business, but the important thing to remember is there is always risk associated with that. And you know, making long-term plans when you're getting lots of short-term hits on wage costs is, you know, is sometimes difficult.
Well, yeah, and increased wage costs make investment harder, because the people look at their P&L for the next year and say, I can't make the money which is going to pay off this investment I've made. Yeah. So it is a catch-22.
And also it's the two things coming together. So on the one side, you have the wage costs coming up, and the other side, you have the regulation coming in. And then those two at the same time add additional administrative costs plus overall costs on, you know, for operating the business. So they're the real challenge when you put them together, plus all the additional costs on top of just your wage costs. There are, you know, holiday pay, pension entitlements, an increase in statutory sick pay.
And the people that aren't on minimum wage are probably thinking, where's my 5%, 6% pay rise as well? There's that squeeze at the,
exactly,
at the top
the
end.
The differentials
as well.
are really get quite slim, and then you've got to try and, you know, sell that job to someone that they're taking on more responsibility, but actually the differentials are very small.
Yeah. Okay, well, those are just three of the really big things that have happened this week. There's been quite a few more than that, actually, and I think if you're a member, to check out the weekly briefing, because we'll have more detail on all of these. It's essentially been a week for government departments and ministers to get everything off their desks. We're now about to head into the unknown with a new Prime Minister and what will likely be probably a brand new agenda when MPs return from their summer holidays. Lucky them. We'll be back soon to talk about what all this means for the local shops. But until then, make sure that if you do one thing, it's book your place at Heart of the Community, London, October 15th. This is our main political event of the year. And I mean, as you've heard, the agenda is already shaping up to be a big one. You can book your place free online at acs.org.uk.